order.
And we are going to move right along, members. We're going to give 15 minutes per bill for the first four so that we save the last half hour for our final issue. So we are inviting Representative Fisher to the table, and you're joined by one testifier.
Yes, ma'am.
Welcome to the. These are informational only. All of the bills today. Do we have any of them in our possession? We have none of them in our possession. So we are hearing them for information only. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Peter, Representative Peter Fisher. I am coming for you today with Bill 682. Basically, what this is doing is providing a monitoring system to understand better what is happening with groundwater within the state. We've seen quite a bit in the papers in both St. Paul and Minneapolis lately about the major issues of not having enough water. In some areas, lakes drying up, and other areas where there's not enough water to meet the drinking and industrial needs in different parts of the state. And so I have an expert with me to give kind of a primer to help do some education as to how these water issues interplay back and forth, and the reason we need an improvement on our monitoring well system so that we can get things done on more of a timely basis. The way it's set up right now, it would take 90 years to get the, at current funding rates, to get the monitoring wells throughout the state, but we've got problems that we should have been working on 10 years ago, so we're a little behind the curve. So at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Jason Meckel.
And Mr. Meckel, if you would also please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jason Meckel, Department of Natural Resources, Division of Ecological and Water Resources. As Representative Fisher had indicated, we are behind. We've currently got 800 wells that we use to monitor water levels throughout the state. That's an average of one well for 88 square miles. Wells are the only real reliable way that we have of knowing what's happening with our water. In surface waters, we can measure the flow in a river. We can measure water levels in lakes. And we have over 1,000 lakes in which we measure water levels, and we've got many stream gauges around the state, but we're way behind on our groundwater levels. And groundwater is extremely complex. There are many, many small aquifers in which we have virtually no data. We put together a plan a couple of years ago and looked at all the different aquifers, all the varied geology that we have, and estimated that we need close to 7,000 wells to do an adequate job of keeping track of this resource. We're currently at 800, and as Representative Fisher said, at the funding levels that we've been operating with, which are listed on the sheet of paper that I believe you have, there's previous bonding numbers there. 2010, we have $1 million. 2011, we had 600,000, and that's pretty much what we're relying on. There's been a little bit of clean water fund dollars that we've been able to direct to these wells, but at the current pace, it'll take us about 90 years to get this network built out. I don't know what the number is going to be in the governor's budget yet for a bonding bill, but the $9.5 million that was proposed by Representative Fisher, we've estimated that that would about double our current network. We could probably get about 800 wells in around the state with that $9.5 million.
Just looking at your dollars, if you had a greater influx of money, what's the staffing issue around which, I mean, obviously, financing is one thing, but staffing to accomplish the work, how would that be possible?
Madam Chair, great question. We're trying to address the staffing that's needed to actually gather the data, because this is just money puts the well in the ground. To actually gather the information and analyze that information, we're addressing that through a water management fee, appropriation fee bill that's also been introduced by Representative Bogenius on behalf of the administration. So you're absolutely right. We do need staff resources to actually use the information. You know, we can use bonding money for the staff needs to get the wells in the ground. And I would add that, by and large, we rely on contractors to do this. Most of this ends up being done through private contract. A lot of these wells are beyond our capacity to drill. We've got a drill rig, but it's a pretty small rig. It works for the fairly shallow types of wells. But some of these wells through our bedrock aquifers can cost $100,000. Just for one well. Now, we wouldn't put that many of those in, but we have some needs. I would just point to a map that we've provided for you here. This is labeled density ranking. Unfortunately, I don't think you have the color copy. Maybe you do. But if you just look at it, this is essentially where we would target the installation of monitoring wells. These areas that are colored in or shaded, this is where we're experiencing the most growth in the use of our groundwater. It's around agricultural irrigation, small communities, rails, roads, gas lines. Those things tend to correspond with increased water use. So it gives you an idea where we target. And then there's another map that I've provided here, a legend that says active DNR groundwater level monitoring wells, series of dots. You know, this can be a bit deceiving because you can look at this and say, well, it looks like we've got fairly good coverage. But as I said, that's one well for 88 square miles. It's just not adequate to understand what's happening with our water levels. And one way to illustrate that is on the next map that I've provided, there's next sheet, there's four maps of the state. And on that, what you see is depictions of the underlying geology and what that means in terms of our aquifers. And so a well in one part of the state can get to one aquifer, but it doesn't adjust necessarily the aquifer above it or the aquifer below it. And in the southeastern part of the state, Twin Cities east and down, we have multiple bedrock aquifers. We have to put a well in each aquifer to get a handle on what's going on, how much is water moving vertically and also horizontally, and what the flow rates are. So it's fairly complex. It's hard to get a handle on it, but we've put together a 100-page report that depicts why we need what we need, where we need them in general. And I'll give you just the last table here. This shows you where the 6,835 would be located in which aquifers, how many we currently have, and what the goal is to get a better handle on our water, groundwater resources. Take any questions?
Represent that, Mayor.
Yeah. Just a quick question. Is there any other technology available, like they use in the oil industry, to look at the amount of oil that's in the ground? Is there any technology? Do they use the same technology? Do they drill just to see what there is? Is there electronic technology out there now?
Mr. Meckel?
Madam Chair and Representative, I'm not aware of any technology that allows us to look down through multiple aquifers and measure what the water levels are. To the best of my knowledge, this is the only way we can do it.
Okay.
There's another part of the equation, and that is that we also need to know what's coming out in terms of what's discharging, but also what's being pulled out of the ground. And we're working on those aspects, but this is specifically targeted at water levels and how they're changing over time.
Yeah. And Madam Chair, and we is it a 2-inch drill, or is it a 4-inch, a 6-inch? Most of us that have owned homes have put in wells. What type of casing do you use on this?
Mr. Meckel.
Madam Chair, Representative, we typically are using a 4-inch casing. We lower equipment down in there so that we can get water level readings. We also use these for water chemistry sampling whenever that's appropriate. So, but 4-inch is the standard.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
And Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess as I look at the bill, and I might have a question for Ms. Dyson if she's available. Can you give the committee and me, especially, some historical perspective in terms of the protocol, in terms of how we bond for these types of what's been past procedure in terms of bonding for municipal groundwater wells or monitoring of them? Is there any precedence?
Ms. Dyson, is that something you can now? What I'm wondering about is this top sheet. Does that sort of answer his question, the history?
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, what the responsibility is shared by the municipalities for testing and monitoring their own versus the state's perspective on this matter?
Ms. Dyson?
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, with the groundwater monitoring wells, I believe the use of the state bond funds has been exclusively for DNR and its programs, that this isn't tied to the municipal programs, which I think are monitored through the Department of Health. But as the cover sheet from the department points out, there's been bonding a couple of times for groundwater monitoring wells, but it's not tied to municipal well programs.
And Mr. Meckel may have some additional information.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, the monitoring wells that municipalities do is often a requirement of a specific impacts of their use on an aquifer. What these wells are intended to do is give us a better handle on the aquifers in general around the state, individual aquifers, but not necessarily in the places where we have the most intensive use. So we do require communities to monitor, and they often install their own monitoring wells, where we're trying to figure out how much drawdown is occurring because of their use in a specific location. These wells are generally in places where there's not really intensive use, and I know that's a little bit tricky to understand because it's very complex to, with the geology that we have. As the sheet indicates, we do and have historically used bonding dollars to expand the monitoring network. The history on this monitoring network, these 800 wells, is that we've inherited a lot of these wells. Many of these wells are old municipal wells or private wells that people were just going to abandon. And we said, hey, you know, don't seal that. We could use that information in that location. It's an old network. It's cobbled together. There wasn't a strategic effort until very recently, and that's what the path we're on now is actually a strategic plan laid out and how to get there.
Any follow-up?
Just one. In terms of monitoring of the data coming out of the well itself, is that transmitted to you electronically, or is there someone actually going out to the site and collecting it? How do you receive and collect the information that you're coming up out of the ground with?
Mr. Meckel?
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, it's a mixture. Some of our more recent installations, we have electronic data loggers in them, and we have them set up on a telemetry station so that we can get real-time data, and we post that on our website. We can't do that with every well. Most of our new wells that we're putting in have a device that we lower down in there, and they record water level on an hourly basis, and we go out quarterly, check the well, make sure everything's okay, download that data, get it into a database, and then we can post that information, and we have that all available on our website. But the standard is still to go out there with a steel tape, mark it with chalk, lower it down till you hit the water, and bring it back up and check it, and get very accurate measurements. And a lot of those are done through cooperators. We use local units of government, soil and water conservation districts, to help us out with those measurements. And then our staff go out as well. So it's a combination.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sub Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Meckel, just looking at the map, in the Northeast Metro area, I represent area adjoining Representative Fisher's, which is the White Bear Lake area, where we've seen a real problem with White Bear Lake water level, and a lot of that has been anecdotally and somewhat technically tied to the aquifer about 400 feet down. There's another aquifer about 1,000 feet down. When I look at this, and we've got some, not just White Bear Lake, but some other smaller lakes in the Northeast Metro area that are really seeing some pressure, I don't see how this is going to help me in my district. Can you talk to me about that a little bit?
Mr. Meckel.
Madam Chair and Representative, certainly we've been accelerating the installation of monitoring wells in the 11-county metropolitan area. We had a one-time appropriation of Clean Water Fund dollars for $5 million. We've spent about $2 million of that installing wells throughout the metro, including up in the White Bear Lake area in the Northeast Metro. A number of new wells have gone in just in the last couple of years. And that money is going to run out at the current rate within a couple more years, and then we don't have any more money to install any more wells. So these monitoring wells will be targeted in the metro as well as outstate. And so they are going to give us the information that we need to get a better handle on long-term trends in our aquifers as well as seasonal trends in aquifers and how they're related to our surface waters. This doesn't address the surface water piece. We get at that through water level monitoring in our lakes, streams, and wetlands, which we're trying to address through the other funding proposal that's out there.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Meckel, I think the when I look at the map and look at how you're targeting the use of this $10 million, it appears to be geared towards development and future use, but I think we have a real urgent need in the Northeast Metro to look at what's going on immediately. So I'd like to see a little different response on that, and just in terms of what the problem is currently. And then secondarily, if you could respond to just, we've appropriated what looks to be, according to the sheet, about $1.6 million, of which you've got about $425,000 that has not been used in terms of bonding appropriations that we've given the DNR that you've not yet spent. Can you talk to us a little bit about, if we were to appropriate this much money, when would that money be spent, and how quickly could we expect the DNR to turn around on uptake and spend the money and get the wells on the ground?
Mr. Meckel.
Madam Chair and Representative, great question. We have a number of new contracts underway that are rapidly spending down the balance that we have, but there is a bit of a ramp-up time. It takes staff to figure out where to locate these and work through the contracting process. But $9.5 million, my estimate is that would be, we could spend that within probably 3 to 4 years, at the longest, but 3 to 4 years. It take a little ramp up time, but we've got a pretty good system in place now. The other thing is we coordinate this with all the other agencies, so these wells don't just serve our needs, they're also serving PCA's needs, Department of Agriculture, wherever we can, when they make sense to do so. And in terms of the 11 County Metro, maybe my answer earlier didn't indicate this, but we've certainly made it a priority to make sure that we're filling in the gaps in the metropolitan area, and we're working as quickly as we can to get those wells installed and get them equipped with the data loggers so we get the data that we need.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Meckel, for coming in this morning. We appreciate your time. Thanks.
And I did hear the urgency, I mean, that and that question about priorities. When you see a clear issue, do you target more than once?
Yeah.
Wow, we have lots of questions. Representative Green.
Oh, boy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Meckel. I'm looking at this, and we've been doing studies for years. You got 800 wells out there. What have you concluded so far? Is it, you have any conclusions yet, and you want to dump a bunch more? And where can we get the information that you've in your data that you've concluded on this?
Mr. Meckel.
Madam Chair, Representative Green, I can tell you, not for every part of the state, but foremost in my mind, I can tell you of some of the data, particularly in the metropolitan area, as was indicated in the Northeast Metro up in the White Bear Lake area, we are seeing downward trends in water levels. We have a 60-year data record, which is quite rare for this state, out in Orono, Lake Minnetonka area, that shows a 60-year downward trend, consistently downward trend. Dakota County, we're seeing a similar thing. Out in the Eden Prairie Edina area, the aquifers that we look at there, we're seeing downward trends. Some of these records are 5 years old, some are 10 years old, some are 20 years old. The longer the record, the more clear we can get a handle on, is this an actual trend? Is this part of a cycle? Where are we at? And unfortunately, a lot of what we have is very recent data. So it's really inconclusive in lots of parts of the state. I'm focused on the bedrock aquifers in the metropolitan area, which behave a little differently than what we have in greater Minnesota. In greater Minnesota, the issue is not so much whether or not there's a downward trend in the aquifer over a longer period of time, but what happens during the season. A lot of the groundwater use in greater Minnesota is seasonal use, agricultural irrigation. And what we see with monitoring systems there is that the water levels go down in the summer, they gradually rebound throughout the winter, and then they return to nearly the same level by the spring. The problem is that as we do that, those aquifers are also connected to the lakes, the wetlands, and the streams in the nearby area, and so we can be affecting the water levels in those systems as we're drawing them down throughout the summer, because these tend to be surficial systems. They're connected. It's what we think of as a water table aquifer. We have other parts of the state where there are some real chronic issues with water availability. Some of that's being exacerbated by drought. But that's not to say that everywhere in the state we have a problem. But we don't have information everywhere in the state either, so that's a big part of the challenge. It's the gap that we've focused in on, is that we just don't know enough. But where we do have information, there's reason to be concerned, and we're working hard to address those issues.
So we have four more questions. I'd urge short questions and short answers. Right. Representative Detmer.
Madam Chair, short question, and Mr. Meckel. when you go on and when you select a site for a well, is it on state land, private land, public land? Do you have to get permits to go in and drill a well? What's your procedure there?
Mr. Meckel.
Madam Chair, Representative Detmer, we usually put them on public land. We work with county parks. We work on state land, wildlife management areas, wherever we can, so we make sure that we've got a long-term protection of that investment.
Representative Albright.
Thank you. And, I'm looking at this graph you've got here, and I'm a bit surprised, a bit dismayed, candidly, that with the issue of going after and mining for trace minerals, particularly in Representative Moline's area and others, that you're not siting wells in the Arrowhead region. And I'm just wondering what, with the issues that are relevant to that, why you're not placing more of an emphasis up in that region.
Mr. Meckel.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, tough to answer this one short, but I'll describe it this way. The geology up there is so different that there's very little reliance on groundwater, and there isn't very much groundwater. But we have targeted the places where those issues are more prominent. You could see that there's all these areas in yellow. We just lack very basic information in the Arrowhead. County geologic atlases, in fact, we're still trying to figure out with the Minnesota Geological Survey how to do them up there because it's such different bedrock situation. So we're not ignoring it. It's just a different situation, and it requires a little bit different approach.
And Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And in response to Representative Green's question, you were basically talking about information that is being gained. That we're becoming more educated through the examination of these wells and their results. Would you tell me, is the goal at some point some concrete recommendations or some suggestions and what can be done about our water supply in Minnesota as a result of what you've learned?
Mr. Meckel.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, that would be the intent, is that once we can figure out what's going on, then we can start to figure out collectively, not just DNR, but collectively with the community of users, what do we need to do to address the issue long term? If the water level is declining, that's not sustainable long term. We need to address it. So how do we do that? And the quicker we can get that information and address the issue, we think the better off we are. We're more proactive rather than reactive. We see what some of the reactive crises kinds of situations we have to deal with, and we're trying to get out in front of it.
Representative McNamer.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I've monitored groundwater for years by looking at the surface of permanent ponds and lakes. Isn't that an easy way to monitor how your level of groundwater is going?
Mr. Meckel.
Madam Chair and Representative McNamer, yes and no. Where the surface waters are directly connected to the groundwater aquifers, it gives us an indication. But you also have to try to figure out and separate, well, what's happening short-term drought? Is it just a precipitation pattern issue? So let me use a bank account analogy. If I know what my balance is, but I don't know what my inflow and my outflow is, that tells me one thing. And we need to get a better handle on the inflow, the outflow, and the balance to get a better handle on how we're managing our water.
May I ask one last question?
Very quickly. We have two more, and I'm going to cut this off.
Permit lakes and ponds are where the surface area dips below the water table. Isn't that a good indication of the level of the water?
Mr. Meckel.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, it is where they are in more direct contact. But oftentimes, and like here in the metropolitan area, we have bedrock aquifers that we rely on for our water supply that are not in contact with, with our surface waters. Lake Minnetonka doesn't tell me anything about the Prairie du Chien Jordan aquifer that is what we rely on here for most of the Twin Cities water supply.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Meckel, early in the session, we heard good testimony about the severe climate activity. And so you're monitoring what impact would severe climate activity have on that? I mean, either drought or over precipitation or whatever. Would that play a factor at all? And then all of your data to say, where you want to have these monitoring wells, would that change? Or
Mr. Meckel?
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, I'm not quite sure I'm understanding the question, but I think I'll take a quick shot. Groundwater levels are going to respond to long-term climatic patterns. They respond to water use withdrawal as well. So we're obviously monitoring precipitation and all kinds of weather-related information around the state, and that's a part of this, understanding the water balance. But having water level trend information is also key. I'm not sure that I quite understand the excuse me, connection in terms of climate fluctuations.
Just the severe climate activity that we heard about early in the session, whether it be a drought, whether it be a flood, whatever it was, does that impact your data and your monitoring?
Mr. Meckel.
Madam Chair, Representative Ward, climatic fluctuations certainly relate to what happens with water levels. Dry periods, you'll detect that in water levels, in surface waters as well as groundwater. Precipitation changes, high-intensity storms generally come with a lot more runoff, and that means less recharge. So those things are, it's all very much related, yes, to the water level.
Last question, Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are you eligible for legacy money?
Mr. Meckel.
Madam Chair and Representative, yes, we are using Clean Water Legacy dollars currently. I mentioned a one-time appropriation for the 11-county area, and then we've got a small amount that I've described here, $250,000 annually that we're directing towards monitoring wells. But as Representative Fisher said, at the current pace of funding, we're on a 90-year timeline.
Thank you. I think, so this was for information. We thank you very much. Lots of questions, as you can tell. And we're going to move ahead to Representative Nornes, who I think has what we call back of the bill work, change in language for an existing bonding authorization. Welcome, Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We'll begin with you, and you can let us know what order your testifiers
are. Okay. I believe the packet should have included a handout similar to this. If you find that gives you all of the information regarding the project we're dealing with in Fergus Falls, which is the former state hospital. And this bill, 1622, deals with some language and how the city can proceed using some bonding authority that's already been given to them, and it extends the period of time by another 2 years. And I'd like to, first of all, turn the hearing over to Mayor Hal Leland, and also we'll be hearing from a councilman following Hal.
Welcome, Mr. Leland. And please identify yourself for the record.
I am Hal Leland, Mayor of the City of Fergus Falls. And Madam Chairman, and members of the Capital Investment Committee, thank you for the opportunity for this fact-finding hearing and for us to provide this information to you regarding House File 1622, which has been authorized by Representative Bud Nornes and Representative Jay McNamer. We also appreciate the efforts of Joel Carlson for helping to identify and verify the need for more time to preserve and redevelop this historic icon and restore it to a viable economic engine that will create jobs, grow businesses, and bring families to our community and region. I must first express gratitude to the state of Minnesota for the bonding dollars which have been standing for some time that have been allocated through the original grant from the Department of Administration, and particularly to Wayne Wislowski for his constant cooperation and help in working through this bonding process, and also to this committee for your previous and present support for capital projects in our area. After many years of working with numerous developers and investors, it's clear more time is needed to enable developers to phase in sections of this enormous facility, over 500,000 square feet, and to be able to have flexibility in stabilizing and preserving it rather than demolishing it. We are here to ask for more time, not for more dollars, but also more flexibility in how we utilize those dollars to provide at least a fair chance for investors to have an opportunity to go forward with development. I'll gladly answer any questions and concerns you might have during this hearing, but I also want you to hear from second-term Alderman Jay Sykos, who will reiterate the resolve and commitment that our City Council has for redevelopment and preservation. Thank you.
Mr. Sykos, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the
record. Thank you, Madam Chair. Jay Sykos, Third Ward City Councilman from Fergus Falls. I would echo the thank yous that our mayor just talked about to the state for previously providing us bonding dollars and for Department of Administration and others for working with us. We truly see, both on the council and citizenry that have talked with us, that the RTC is one of our most unique pieces of architecture and one of our most important pieces of history in the city. It was an economic driver for a number of years in Fergus Falls, and now that times have changed, we still want to use that campus and see great potential for it going forward. It certainly has been one of our biggest and most trying issues. We were glad to take the property off the state's hands some time ago, but we want the building. We are excited about the building. We want to protect our path, but we want to redevelop, and I think the campus offers a lot to the suitors that are there. As Mayor Leland stated, it is a request for time. We didn't know when we took the building, and I wasn't on the council at the time, but from everything I'm reviewed, we couldn't have foreseen what kind of economic downturn was going to come. So it was very difficult to get suitors, especially for that magnitude and size of the project. But Colliers has been working hard for us, and we actually have some real decent leads at this point in time, and we think it's a realistic project. But we're right at the edge of where we would need to start talking about demolition, and we would not like to have to do that right now. We would like to know that we can protect this asset but still retain the ability to use this funds and in the end game if that comes. We're excited. We want to keep this property there, and we think we can do that.
And so, members, as you may recall, early in the session when we were talking about this, if money is not expended within 4 years, it automatically cancels. And occasionally, projects like this do come forward with a request to extend to give them some additional time. And in this case, also to change the language, as they said, to provide broader flexibility than maybe that initial language had. So you see the deletion of some early language and some new language. Occasionally we do it, not often, but we refer to these kinds of things as the back of the bill language.
Madam Chair, I should point out that this is a very historic building. It has become kind of a landmark. If you come to Fergus Falls, many people go there specifically because of its uniqueness. We've had two movies that have already been filmed there in the last year or two, something like that, and some other requests. And so it's becoming not only just a local destination, but the more people hear about it, the more reasons we need to keep it, is what I'm saying.
Representative Ward has a question.
Well, Madam Chair, not so much as a question as a comment. And Representative Nernis, I applaud your effort. You know that we in Brainerd had the same issue. You know that.
I do.
And I appreciate your support as we tried to save our facility as well. We weren't as fortunate. Mayor and City Councilman, I applaud your effort to own, to take over the state property. And I assume it is city-owned at this point, correct?
Correct.
And that's where we kind of fumbled. But members, I will tell you this, that right now, and Representative Nornis and I just talked about this recently, right now, as we move forward with some things in our area, we certainly wish we have three buildings out of the, I think, 17 that still remain. We wish we had those 14 other buildings back. And Chair Hausman, you know in the past what kind of effort we've done with that. So, you know, you're really doing a credit and service to the citizens of your area, but also in the state when you're trying to preserve that great facility. And the only question I have is one of the things that was very difficult for us to, once we vacated the buildings, the cost to put them, occupy them again was prohibitive. It was significantly huge. And I read here it was, I think, how much is to, are your buildings empty right now, and how much would it be to occupy them again?
Mayor?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm going to refer that question to Mr. Kent Madsen, who is a grant administrator and has all the technical knowledge that's answers that are needed here. But yes, it is completely empty. It is cold storage, in fact, at this point in time. But may I call on Kent to just address that.
I also just want to point out to Representative Ward that it's one building, one giant building. It's not several buildings. It's the other unique part of it. It's like a town within a building.
Mr. Madsen, please identify yourself.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kent Madsen. I've been a consultant with the City of Fergus Falls on the RTC project for about 11 to 12 years. Representative Norris and the Mayor are correct. Right now, the buildings are presently vacant. They have been placed into cold storage. There has been quite a bit of hazardous abatement work done over the years to make them ready for redevelopment. We have seen stabilization in redevelopment costs ranging from $8 million on the low side up to $50 million on the high side. Over the years, we have seen a lot of people come up with some very creative ideas to use all of the square footage in Fergus Falls, and some of the grander plants have had the very high redevelopment costs and some of the more step-by-step or phased-in approach processes have had that $8 million cost range. But it is a substantial financial commitment, we do have some very real prospects right now that seem to have the wherewithal from the history of developing similar properties as well as acquiring capital financing to make a project like this happen. And we're also working with other local agencies to make creative funding packages like new market tax credits, historic tax credits available to assist with the developers.
Representative Mahoney has a question, and then we're going to have to move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Nordis, or to whomever. Which movies were made there?
I don't think you've seen either one of
Nornis.
Them. I would say, I don't even know if they had a name. No, they all had a central theme, I think, of being kind of a spooky.
I was just wondering if they had snowbait money.
I don't think it's not a Fargo or a Grumpy Old Men type movie, but it's a real movie. Nice.
Well, thank you so much for bringing this issue before us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now we have is Representative Hamilton? Yes, Representative Hamilton is in the room, and this also is a reauthorization. This is a little different in that this actually will have to be a reauthorization that appears on the spreadsheet as opposed to back of the bill. Representative Hamilton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This is a proposal. We actually secured dollars for a bioscience infrastructure park here back in 2005. And there are some dollars that fell to the bottom line. And since we designed that bioscience infrastructure, we do have a number of companies that are located there. Specifically, we have Prairie Holdings, and that encompasses a number of different companies, whether it's ProPig or Cattle Specialties, Newport Labs, so we also have Bioverse. And what we've done is the City of Worthington has worked close with the public schools and the Minsky system as far as offering up lab tech training as well to get the next generation, if you will, encouraged and enthused about opportunities within the bioscience industry and in agriculture. So, Madam Chair, I do have two testifiers here as well. If I could turn it over to them, and they could share a little more light on this project.
Yes, welcome. Who's
Madam Chair, Craig Clark, Administrator of the City of Worthington. I just want to compliment Representative Hamilton on his comments there. This has been over decades of work for the community to build on our strength in animal biosciences. As you mentioned, we had an appropriation for infrastructure built out of the facility. We've done that. We've also constructed an incubator space that has an incubator space for business development and also development of the Biotechnology Advancement Center. Currently, the University of Minnesota Extension is in there. And Bioverse, who I'll introduce here shortly, is also occupying the business incubator space. As part of that project, we have area for a lab build-out, and that would be what we're looking to repurpose the dollars for that we didn't expend of the $2.5 million that was appropriated. But this is a public-private partnership, as well as working with our local school district and Minnesota West Community and Technical College to build that applied lab technicians and build on our strength that we have for our business creators in the community. With me is Glenn Thuringer. He's president of Bioverse, and we're proud to have him occupy the business incubator. And development happens slowly in greater Minnesota, and we work hard at it every day, and we're fortunate to have them occupy that facility for us. But we'd ask your consideration for continuation of those funds so that we can continue to do the work of the Advancement Center that we put forward.
And Mr. Thuringer, would you like to add comments as well?
Please. Madam Chair, I'm Glenn Thuringer, President and CEO of Bioverse. And I'd like to just clarify something because we might get a little confused here. I've been in front of this committee a number of times for the last 14 and a half years. I was the manager of the Worthington Regional Economic Development Corporation, and about 6 months ago, after recruiting Bioverse to the Bioscience Park and into the center, I had the opportunity to join the company and run the company. So I have a lot of background in developing the Bioscience Park and specifically the center. Representative Hamilton and City Administrator Clark did a nice job of giving the background. I'll try not to repeat that, but be able to give additional input. Bioverse is a company that is growing. It's approximately 17 years old, but only about the last 4 to 5 years have been actively selling. We sell a water remediation product that is a microbial that, when entered into the water, it'll consume the nutrients in the water, eventually starving out the algae. And how this ties together, and just for purpose, I'm going to pass this around and represent Mahoney. You can take that out of plastic if you like. This is one of our main products that we manufacture. The point that I want to make by passing this around is we have the opportunity to do a lot more research and development and advance the company and be much better at what we're doing. The lab that is potential for in the center would be very critical for us. When I negotiated the project to bring Bioverse to Worthington, because they were in Minnesota, we were currently in Minnesota, we were leaving. I get sometimes confused if I'm a we or a they. And we're leaving Minnesota, and we were able to keep them in Minnesota. And one of the attractions, and we have a memorandum of understanding put together with Bioverse to use the center, the lab in the center, once the center's been developed. We know that we can create additional jobs by having the lab, and we'd really like to be able to partner with our community and technical college and the city and other businesses by using the lab and having a preferably a staffed research position in the center.
And so, members, the amount we're talking about then is the unexpended portion, $313,000, just almost $314,000, and normally would cancel and would be reauthorized for continued use on this project. Representative Mahoney has a question. All right, were you finished with your testimony?
Yes, that's fine.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for any one of the testifiers, how many labs are pretty much defined by the number of hoods or fume hoods they put in, and how many they can, that gives you the number of stations you can work at. How many fume hoods will 319,000 or whatever it is buy you?
Mr. Thuringer?
Madam Chair, Representative, we are planning on putting in 3 hoods. 2 of them will be a little bit lower. Level 1 will be vented through the ceiling, which in technical terms makes it a higher standard hood, which would allow more research and testing to be done. And then I believe there's room for 32 students in the lab at one time. So this is very much a industry and educational base, so it's really a convergence on industry and education. Thank you for the question.
Representative Mahoney.
One follow-up. Other than the I think it's Newport Labs right across from where this is located. Other than the private industry facility, is there another lab of this nature with this kind of fume hoods and other stuff anywhere within the area of Worthington?
Mr. Thuringer?
Madam Chair and Representative, other than private sector, I believe the question, there really is not. If you were to include the labs at the Community and Technical College, then it's a yes, but very limited access to them by the private sector. I hope that answers your question. Thank you. One thing I'd like to point out. Thank you. A few years back, the Economic Development Office started an eighth grade science club. And you've heard this. You want to tell?
No.
And we have been very active. They've been here to the state capitol, and it's really our feeder program to go through the high school program and into the college program, and we really feel that we have to have the government support, the private sector support, and the educational systems all come together to help bring these young minds forward into the sciences. Now, there's a lot of job opportunities. We have to do a better job of getting the kids exposed to the opportunities. So that's part of the plan, and it's unfolding very nicely, I might add.
Representative Earhart has a question.
Madam Chair, can someone explain to me, is that $313,000 sitting in an account somewhere, or is it unlet bonds? Or
this would have already been appeared on the cancellation report, so it would have never gone to the local government there and would have been canceled, and we're, in a sense, reauthorizing that amount.
Oh, Madam Chair, they issue bonds in the amount of $313,000, or is that some kind of a pool? Or
Mr. Thuringer wants to speak.
Madam Chair, Representative, a few years back, we were awarded $2.5 million to put in the infrastructure into the Bioscience Park. The city did a very diligent job of getting that accomplished. Things came in under budget, and these are dollars that remained from that $2.5 million. And is now going back to the state because we did not have to use all of it. And we're just simply asking if we could reposition them into the center to finish off the lab space. The lab is 1,972 square feet. We have it stubbed in. We just need to get it finished off for use. Thank you.
Madam Chair, the money you actually have in an account somewhere then?
No.
Representative Hamilton.
Madam Chair, the city does not hold those dollars. It was issued by the state through the bonds, and they weren't all used for the bioscience infrastructure.
So it's a bond account remaining held by the state?
That's correct.
It's cash, though. It's not.
No, it is geobonding.
It's geobonding.
Geobonding.
Well, yes, I understand that, Madam Chair, but where is the 313?
It's still in the possession of the state.
So the bonds have been let, but the money is sitting here in an account.
No, bonds have not been. Those bonds have not been let. They were authorized and unexpended.
I understand that, but I didn't think that you would issue bonds in the amount of $300,000. That's my question,
I don't know if one of our staff wants to talk about the, I mean, it's.
This happens periodically, Madam Chair, I assume.
Right. What the state does is, as it requires sort of the flow of this of these bonds,
okay,
they have the bond sales, and so they pace those bond sales depending on how the bonding money needs to flow out. I don't know if that's cash flow.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Yes, a final comment?
Yes, Madam Chair. Just one other thing. This is really the last piece of that Biotechnology Advancement Center for us to finish the lab. And it's really a job creator. I really want to emphasize the efforts that we've done. And it's not just private sector, but the continuum that we've had with the schools and Minnesota West and the private sector. This is the last piece as far as build out of the Biotechnology Advancement Center and then development of our industrial park. Part of that incubator then is to spur off people to build in our bioscience park there as well. So I want to focus on the job creation element of this reauthorization. Thank you.
Representative Hamilton, any closing comments?
Thank you for your consideration.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
You.
Thanks for coming. And for House File 960, we're joined by Representative Dorhold and Representative O'Driscoll. I think you're both going to present. And in this case, it's asking for a reauthorization for something that would cancel. So you'll probably be telling us why we're extending. Representative Dorhold, are you you're first?
Sure. Yeah. I guess we'll keep it brief. We're. I'll start with. I was an intern with the city of Startell back in 2005 when we were then hopeful about getting this piece of property into parkland. It's something that also one of my predecessors, Larry Haas, was also working hard on for almost decades. I know a few of you have been up there. It's right on the river that separates O'Driscoll's and my districts. So something we're pretty excited
about. And I don't know whether any of this group, we have toured it. I believe this was referred to as the Daler Farm, right? And so you pass the farmhouse and then you kind of go down a hill into a very secluded area. Representative Dean might have been along. I'm not sure. As I look around the table, Representative Carlson probably was there because he had perfect attendance.
Madam Chair,
at these tours,
I was there.
Ah, Representative Riddle. Continue.
Representative O'Driscoll, speak to more of it?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll. And as Representative Dorhold pointed out, this is actually property that comes on the convergence of his district and my district. And so as Central Minnesota has been well known to do, they prioritize what their needs are and come to the legislature. And so I'm happy to partner today with Representative Dorhold on the reauthorization of this property. A little bit of quick background on it. It is about 68 acres plus or minus. That's located on Stearns County Road 120, which is across the street from a rapidly developing commercial area where major box retailers are. And if not but for the slowing economy, this property that we're talking about right now would no doubt have been purchased and put into development. And this property is on the Sauk River at the point that it merges into the Mississippi River. It's also a bottle eagle habitat. And property for model eagle habitat. It's also on a state canoe route. It is also, if purchased and placed into a park, will connect with trails that are designated trails along the Sauk River that extend into what would be Representative Tice's district, since all of those kind of converge in that same area. We had two things that are being modified in this. One is, as of December 31st of 2012, the authorization ran out from the 08 bonding authorization. And we came to the state to ask for money and then entered into negotiations. And those were kind of start and stop negotiations. And on or about the 15th of January this year, a purchase agreement was struck contingent upon the renewal of the bonding authorization that expired on December 31st of the previous year. And we've also done a modification of the number of acres. Our original request was for a 50% match on the entire purchase of that, and for other needs in the 08 bonding bill, that had been reduced from $2 million down to $500,000. And so we're asking for authorization on that. We do have a purchase agreement with the property owners contingent upon this money and local match, as well as some legacy money that was procured as the DNR has taken an interest in this property and would like to preserve it as well.
Representative Erdahl has a question.
Madam Chair, not really a question. I was just letting Jenny know that I was there too. But I think it is a good project. I have visited and been several years ago, but I was impressed by the property.
Any other Representative Stupinski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question of the authors. Just from a standpoint of land purchase, and because you're kind of, it seems like you're using some legacy funds and other portions. When it comes to the offer, your purchase agreement, did any of the rules as far as market value and estimated value, 110% or whatever that is, apply to this project, or where does that fall?
Madam
Chair, I will attempt to answer Representative Swazinski's question. Representative Swazinski.
The gentleman from Lyon.
Yes. Representative Swede.
Hey, you.
Yeah. When you ask about market value, are you talking about is it being purchased at market price or is it being, as far as a tax consequence? Seeing you shake your head on the first question, it is being purchased at market value, which is what is required for this type of purchase. And given the very unique nature of this property, it is a rather spendy proposition, but as we've been walking and talking this through the legislature over the years, it is getting statewide acceptance by many, many legislators and wanting to preserve that particular area because it is a rapidly developing area. And as Chair Hausman had indicated, you come off the county road, you go down to an extremely secluded area on a river that butts the about a 60-acre park on the city of St. Cloud side as well. So this is just the further preservation of properties, and there are no state parks that are located in Stearns, Ventnor, Sherburne County. So this is something that with state help that the locals would like to be able to maintain and would not have any state consequences other than or ongoing operating expenses other than the hard cost acquisitions of the land.
And members, we are trying to track between three bills as bills are sort of being put together, because on a number of these projects like this, there might be something in an environment finance bill or in a legacy bill or in the bonding bill, and we do have a couple of staff people who are sort of checking, because sometimes even parts of projects are funded in one and the other, so we're trying to make sure there is no duplication, that we kind of cover the bases. So, do we have any further questions? I don't think we do. So, any final comments? So, the amount that would be reauthorized is on the second page. It's $500,000, and there is some additional language which extends the date, and you're adding up to. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily 68 acres, but up to.
And Madam Chair, if I might, the city continues to actively pursue the other remainderment of that property. And what we're getting into is what I'll call the actual homestead of that property, and the owners are a little hesitant to enter into an agreement at this time because it is the homestead portion of that property.
Mm-hmm. I think that's all the questions, so thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And now our last one. I think we're still waiting for some of your testifiers, but everybody's here. Okay, good. Oh, and actually, before you begin, we've asked our fiscal analyst just to explain to the committee why the bill is before us, much as we did the other day on another. A couple of bills to just explain why it was brought here. So, Mr. Leaf?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 409, as currently engrossed, would authorize the Rochester Area Destination Medical Center to issue bonds that would be backed up by a state general fund appropriation, which would be an appropriation bond for the state. On the currently engrossed bill on Section 13, Subdivision 1, it explains how the debt service would be paid for by the State General Fund. And so it would have an impact on the state's debt management guidelines if the bill were to be adopted. As currently written, $585 million in bond authorizations would go into Guideline 2. That's the guideline of the total principal outstanding and the authorized but unissued state debt. And as the bonds were sold by the Destination Medical Center, what is paid for out of the principal on those bonds would be in Guideline 1. And as currently drafted, there isn't a schedule for the sale of those bonds, but it would impact Guideline 2, and then as the bonds are sold and the state general fund is paying that appropriation, affect Guideline 1.
And when Representative, Governor Pawlenty was in office, he put together a new set of guidelines, and in one case he said, we want to quantify all debt. And you may recall at an earlier conversation we said that meant University of Minnesota and tobacco securitization and Vikings last year and this all sort of go on that sheet, and we have an interest in that because we don't want to exceed those guidelines, but that and even trunk highway bonds are measured there. So when we quantify all debt, we have to make certain we stay within that guideline. It potentially affects what we might do for traditional geobonding as well. So,
Madam Chair, is that in statute or is that some type of...
The guideline?
Yes.
The guideline we are advised never to put in statute because we're the bottom to drop out of the economy without making any change or taking out on any new debt, we could in effect be outside of the guidelines. And so they have always been, Governor Perpich, I think, had the first guideline. It was 3% of the general fund, and then Governor Pawlenty revised those. But the advice is that they should be guidelines and not put in statute.
Well, Madam Chair, how do we go about changing that?
That would be the governor and MMB. I mean, I suppose we could give them advice, but, I mean, they are established in a sense in conversation with the governor and MMB. And you want to be careful about when you change those guidelines. If it looks like you're about to go off the cliff and you you suddenly say we're going to change the guidelines, the bond houses in New York might take notice of that. And so I think the timing of changing guidelines would be out. Were you finished with your question?
Well, actually, I think that there is the trunk highway bonds have their own dedicated source of revenue, and I think there's some reason that they should be separated from the general obligation bonds of the state. So.
Well, we could give that advice to the governor.
Can we just hand it to him on a platter and say, would you please do this? Or do we have to have a formal?
I think it's it would be a conversation worth having.
Thank you.
Any further? Representative Mahoney.
Madam Chair, rather than handing the governor anything like on a platter, wouldn't it be smarter for us as a state to start our own bank, much like North Dakota does? And we don't have to worry about the bond houses in New York, and we could just use all that money ourselves rather than send it over to New York and then to the Cayman Islands and then to Swiss bank account. Oh, wait, I didn't say.
And members, there is a state bank in North Dakota. In fact, that is how they. My understanding is that is how they build their infrastructure in North Dakota. Totally, totally different approach.
Beautiful.
The architecture.
The architecture. Mr. Lee, did we cut you off? Were you finished? So everybody understands why the bill's before us. Representative Norton, welcome. Oh, I'm sorry. Another Representative Davis has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think we need to just a little bit more about the bonds. And we've got some great testifiers here. But the bonds would be left because there was some economic activity going on, and they'd be paid back because the state had recovered money from the increase in income tax. So there's more to it here. It just sounds like we've got some big expenditure, but nothing happens unless something happens. And so I think that needs to be pointed out. Just for logistically, Madam Chair, what is the path of this bill? It's an informational hearing today. Will we actually act on it someday? Does it go back to tax committee to be thrown in an omnibus bill there? Is it a standalone bill? Or how do you foresee this going?
We don't have anything in our possession yet. I think it happened, but because we haven't had a session or for some reason it didn't get to us in time, so we don't have it in our possession. By rule, anything that relates to bonding must be heard here. To your other point, as he pointed out, there are several guidelines, and the place where it does affect whether we expend it or not is the authorized. Once you authorize, even though they might not spend it for, 20 years, it is measured in the one guideline of authorized but not expended. So
And thank you, Madam Chair, but how do you foresee this proceeding? That this committee realizes what a brilliant plan this is and wants to move it somewhere. Is it a separate bonding bill? Does it move back to the tax committee and include an omnibus tax bill, or how do you foresee this proceeding?
Now, I, of course, am not a part of all the conversations. And maybe we'll hear from our testifiers. I think there's ongoing conversation. I do believe that you're being visited today by the governor's chief of staff down in Rochester. So I think there's ongoing conversation, and we probably, because we're so close to needing to move something out of our committee into Ways and Means, we wanted at least to have give them an opportunity to talk about the infrastructure portion of it. And I don't know if you've advised your testifiers. I mean, obviously, we don't discuss the tax pieces today. That's another committee. But as I looked through, what you have, members, is the engrossment that, and I think that's been changed along the way. And so what I saw primarily was on roughly the first three pages. I circle anything that says public infrastructure. I saw it on page one. I saw it on page two, and then on page three. The number five, they talk about intermodal transportation and public transit. They talk about conferencing and conventions, educational. So you see where the portions of the bill are that might relate to us. Further?
And thank you, Madam Chair. And I think as former Majority Leader Pawlenty would say, the situation's fluid, and I just want to thank you for hearing at this point so we can get on with it.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I'm happy to present House File 409, which is the Destination Medical Center bill. It is, as Representative Davids described, a private investment and growth first, invest in infrastructure second bill and initiative. It provides Minnesota with a major economic development opportunity that will deliver significant benefits, stimulating billions in private investment, tens of thousands of new jobs, and billions in tax revenue to the state. Mayo Clinic is currently a world leader in healthcare, the state's largest private employer, and provides billions in economic impact to our state's economy. But without continued growth and innovation, without private investment, and without the public infrastructure that we're asking for today, necessary to support the growth, Mayo Clinic and Minnesota could lose their edge, their competitive edge, as a global destination medical center. Before you today are the bonding portions of the plan to secure Rochester and Minnesota as a medical destination for patients throughout the country and world into the future, and to drive economic growth and job growth for the next 20 years. In the bill, you'll see that there are plans for Mayo to invest in excess of $3 billion of Mayo's private capital in Minnesota to expand buildings and facilities, what they offer to patients from around the world in Rochester. There will be over $2 billion in additional private investments to support patient and visitor and employee, frankly, demand for lodging, housing, retail, hospitality, recreation, and other enhancements. Approximately 30,000 new direct jobs will be created over the 20 years from this expansion. And estimates are for approximately 1,800 to 2,200 construction jobs, and I want to say this clearly, per year in Rochester as a result of this initiative. Hundreds of thousands of new patients and visitors will travel to our state each year. The $585 million proposed public investment will be made over a 20-year period in public infrastructure and improvements that support the growth in employment and visitation and spending in the marketplace. Please note that none of these dollars will go to Mayo Clinic. Mayo is investing its own capital for its growth and infrastructure. These are community infrastructure requests and dollars so that the city of Rochester can grow to handle the growth that Mayo's projecting. The proposal before you enjoys bipartisan support, support from business and many other groups, and I think you'll hear that here in a few moments. We've heard the chair's concern about debt capacity. We're glad we're having the opportunity to talk about this today. We are, as was mentioned, this bill is in flux. We are working to find ways to address Representative Lincheski's concerns in the tax committee that may or may not impact what we're doing here with our bonding request, but we will keep you apprised and hope that this can be laid over and we can keep working on it and have a bill in just the next few weeks. So with that, I thank you for allowing us to present today, and I have some testifiers that will kind of give details, and then we're happy to answer any questions.
And members, you have the fiscal note, but again, it's for this was probably for the initial bill, I'm guessing, the fiscal note that's before us, and perhaps not even the engrossment we have before us. We also thought it might be interesting for you to see a letter from our files just to show the idea has been around for a while. You have a letter from the Mayo Clinic to leaders in Rochester dated November 2009, where they first talk about, in the second paragraph, destination medical community. And at that point, they were weighing in support of the convention center in Rochester. And I think our argument for the convention center always was it was unique in the state. It would, in fact, draw in business, a convention business that no other city would, simply because of the location of Mayo, that that national and international medical communities would be interested in coming there. So I just thought it was an interesting...
Thank you. And Madam Chair, I would like to just make clear for the committee, since that other proposal is before you as well, that this is not in competition. Well, I would say, I don't even want to talk about competition, but it's a separate bill. And the Mayo Civic Center, as you stated, has been waiting a long time for its day in the sun. It was the city's top priority. This will complement it, as you have the Destination Medical Center as a complement to the Civic Center proposal. So we do hope that you will keep that into consideration, and it is not meant to replace that request of the city that's been waiting for many, many years for approval. So with that, we'll let our testifiers go, if it's okay with you.
Who's first? Whoever it is, please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Gary Newman. I've worked for the city of Rochester for a long time. I'm here on behalf of the mayor. He's got a number of critical meetings down in Rochester today that he couldn't part with. I would mention that I moved to Rochester in 1982, and at the time the city was about 57,000 people. It's 107,000 now. It's basically doubled in size. It's mainly been driven by the growth of the Mayo Clinic. When I moved to Rochester, they had about 14,000 employees in Rochester. Now they have about 30,000 plus. I think it's about 32,000 employees in Rochester. We have a workforce of about 110,000 jobs in Rochester. Of those, I would bet that at least half are driven by Mayo. They've got, as I mentioned, over 30,000 direct employees in Rochester. We have 12,000 people in our hospitality industry. We have 5,500 hotel rooms. Obviously, the reason we have so many hotel rooms in a city our size is because of the Mayo Clinic. The city believes this project is a wonderful opportunity for the state and is the key to our growth and the growth of the whole southeastern region of Minnesota. They draw jobs from everywhere. We have 51,000 people that commute into Rochester for their employment, so it supports a very large area. And I think it's also been excellent for the state economy. I think we're one of the largest contributors countywide of state funding above and beyond the state resources that go back to Homestead County. So from the city's perspective, this, you know, this future investment is a key, not just for us, but for all of southeastern Minnesota, and we believe it's very critical for the state as well. So those are our context comments, and thank you very much for listening.
And continue. Please identify yourself for the record. Welcome.
My name is Brad Narr. I'm a lifetime Minnesotan. I went to the University of Minnesota undergraduate in medical school. I'm a physician at the Mayo Clinic for the last 33 years. It's my job to kind of tell you some of the things that Kim already has alluded to, but I would just like to assure this group that this proposal is about growth. The Mayo Clinic is very big right now. Small amounts of growth will result in lots of jobs. For instance, since 2009, we've added 2,400 jobs just to the Mayo Clinic. And so we believe that we are a hub for the Southern Minnesota Mayo Clinic Health System. For the last 80 years, we have been a destination, and we would like to remain that destination. The world is now flat, and so people can go many, many different places. We think we have something very special there with our completely integrated practice that allows us to accomplish things that many other medical centers just dream about. So thank you very much for your consideration, and I'll let my colleagues get to the details.
We have further testifiers. I think we'll get all the testifiers out and then go to questions. We have two on the list so far for questions.
All right.
And And as you begin, if you would just identify yourself for the record.
Bob Dunn, president of the Hammes Company. We're the lead consultant for the Mayo Clinic on the DMC project. Madam Chair, committee members, for the sake of being brief, I'll make three points picking up on what Representative Norton and Dr. Narr mentioned this morning that really get at what I think the essence of the DMC project is all about in terms of what we'd like to speak to you about today. First, done correctly, I believe strongly that this initiative will make Minnesota the model for economic development in America for the next 10 years or more. And the reason that I say that is there are almost no projects like this that have been structured in this country that are driven by the magnitude of private investment that's being talked about here in relationship to the public investment. In most cases, for this type of economic development initiative, the private dollars and the public dollars are nearly equal. In this case, the private dollars outweigh the public dollars 10 to 1. That in and of itself makes this one of the most unique economic development proposals that I've seen, and I spend every hour of every day working on this type of initiative throughout the country. So I think you have an opportunity to build on the structure of what's being proposed in the DMC, and not only that point, but the fact that you've got an institution with the worldwide recognition and presence of the Mayo Clinic that has proven year in and year out to be one of the most stable employers and generators of tax base in this country. And as Dr. Narr said, even as we've seen a severe downturn in this economy, Mayo has continued to show growth in the state of Minnesota. So you have an opportunity to create a platform here for economic development that very few states, probably no other state in this country, has the opportunity to take advantage of. The second point that I would mention gets the graphic that you see on the screen in front of you. This is a very simple graphic, but it tries to get at the essence of how we've structured this proposal. The idea here is really very simple. What we're trying to do is reverse the structure of how economic development normally occurs. And what I mean by that is the private dollars come in first. Only when the private dollars have been secured and spent, that will create jobs. From that job growth, you will see significant growth in tax base, and a small portion of that new tax base, not existing tax base, there are not new taxes here, and we're not capturing existing tax dollars that come to the state of Minnesota. We're taking a small portion of the new job base and the new tax base that's being created through private investment and using that to build infrastructure. Again, normally it's just the reverse of that. Normally, the risk is on the public sector. Normally, the dollars go in about one-to-one. They go in equally at the beginning, and you are at risk for the growth of tax base. You hope it's going to happen. Here, only when it's secured, only when you've demonstrated that you've received the new tax dollars, is any of that money being spent on infrastructure. The third point that I would make is we've spent a considerable amount of time evaluating what the infrastructure need is going to be in Rochester as a result of more than $5 billion of private investment being made in Rochester over the next decade or more. That alone creates an infrastructure burden in that city that no city of its size could support all on its own. And we've provided you with a report this morning that defines for you not just the makeup of the $585 million, but all of the other elements of infrastructure need and burden that will be placed on the city of Rochester over the next 20 years. And what's important to understand is the $585 million is not the only infrastructure need that we have to deal with in Rochester in the years to come. Rochester has to continue to build its core infrastructure, as any city in Minnesota will do in the next decade. But there's a burden above and beyond what a city normally would have to address simply because of the fact that there's going to be a very rapid pace of growth in the city, and Rochester's normal sources of funding to build infrastructure cannot absorb that added burden. That's why we call it extraordinary cost. The study that you have in front of you is, the title is Infrastructure Master Plan. This is something that we've been working on for many months, but it gives you a summary of the makeup of the $585 million and the other elements of infrastructure that we have to address in Rochester. Madam Chair, the summary, the last page of the study, gives you a table that breaks down in the very far right-hand column. It gives you the breakdown of the makeup of the $585 million. And then if you work across the page to the left, what you'll see in the second column from the left is the total infrastructure burden that the city of Rochester will face over the next 20 years as this private investment occurs in downtown Rochester. So with that, I'll close my comments and have council address some of the other issues.
And then and maybe I should lay out my questions first, because as council finishes, you could put it in that context. Here's the biggest problem I've had in understanding why the big amount for the future, as opposed to thinking about this as something we're going to start this year. And I'll give exact examples that because we're putting a bill together for next week. So as I look at your section, Subdivision 10, the projects, you have streets and roadways. And I know that we will have local road money, and I know from talking to MnDOT, one of those will be in Rochester because they've already targeted it. They know they've had conversation with Rochester about that. So that is likely to happen in this bill. So I see streets and roadways. Then I see in number 5, the intermodal transportation and public transit. MnDOT has made requests for Greater Minnesota Transit. One of those projects is in Rochester this year. They have made a request for continuing to work on the intercity passenger rail, and $5 million of that is for the Rochester connection. And then I see conferencing and conventions, and we hope that maybe this is the year to, in fact, move forward with, in fact, the Civic Center that funds that.
Right.
And I see instructional and educational, and I know this year and every year, part of our higher ed budget, in fact, puts money into those Rochester higher ed facilities. So the confusion I have is, in every one of these areas that I see on your sheet, we're actually going to do something this year. So that's the disconnect I have, why that doesn't count.
Madam Chair, it's a very good question. It's the reason that we've put this report together the way that we have. If what we had done was define for you a $585 million budget and burden, that would have given you a definition of those components of cost. But the reason that we've built this out to the full $1.4 billion infrastructure need in Rochester is to address all of the things that you've mentioned, because there are other elements of infrastructure over and above the $585 million that have to be paid for, and there have to be sources of funding to support that. So, for instance, you mentioned the Civic Center. The Civic Center accounting, if you will, is in this report. And the reason that we wanted to do that was to demonstrate, to prove the point that a city the size of Rochester cannot shoulder this infrastructure burden all on its own. And while you're already planning to address some of those issues in your budgeting, we have accounted for those inside of this report. So the Civic, let me give you the more tangible evidence to that point. The Civic Center. To the extent that the state were to fund a portion of the Civic Center cost, outside of that, the city has to address the other elements of cost. So if you look at the report, the column titled Hotel Tax, that is to address the infrastructure funding that has to come locally from the city of Rochester, whether it's through hotel tax or some other means of local tax. We've accounted for that, showing the $45 million that has to be sourced locally. To the extent that the state contributes to that, that's over and above the $585 million. That's in addition to what's in this report. So what we've tried to provide you with is a full accounting of all the infrastructure needs and costs, and then to address what the various sources will be to pay for that. So some of the transportation dollars that you mentioned, those types of things are being addressed inside of this overall report.
I think maybe we've already got three questions, and I think because I'm watching our clock, I'd like everybody to be able to get their Representative Davids, you're first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a clarification from nonpartisan House research, Mr. Lee, we're talking about appropriation bonds here. What type of a vote of the body would it take to pass appropriation bond? Is that the 50% plus one, or is that the supermajority?
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, that'd be a simple majority.
Okay, thank you. And members of this committee, this is not your average bonding request. This is one that I've studied over the last months and am very excited about. I believe that the Mayo Clinic and their partners have done their due diligence on this issue as is, and I know that in tax committee in the House, there's talking about looking at some different opportunities. But I'd be remiss if I didn't thank Representative Norton for her tremendous work on this bill, Chair Hausman, you for hearing the bill, and Governor Dayton appointing Tina Smith to work on this. Pretty high level things we're talking about here. And so you know it's an extraordinary project if I'm thanking Governor Dayton. But I would be remiss if I didn't do that. This is, I call this the bill of the century, an amazing opportunity, and we have to find a way to do this, and we can do this. We can figure out, we're having the hearings. I think I was just debating with someone, I think Representative Norton has probably set the world record for most committee stops, but then I think maybe Atkins had a few too. But anyways, she's in the top 10 for total committee stops. But this is a situation that is fluid, and I'm glad it's fluid, because if it's fluid, something's moving, and that's a good thing. This is a rare opportunity, members, where we have, if you look at the pack that was handed out, we have labor on board, we have business, we have the chamber on board, we have the area cities on board, the area counties on board. So I guess at this point what I'd say is I thank you, Chair Hausman, for hearing this. We have to find a way to do this, to make this work, not just for southeastern Minnesota, but indeed for the entire state of Minnesota, what this does for economic development, for job creation, for the entire state. So there's a lot of questions, I'm sure, but we can do this. We can find a way to get this done. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And my question would be for Dr. Marr.
Dr.
Narr? Madam Chair, this question has nothing to do with the project itself, but the service that the Mayo Clinic provides. And I've had some family members that have been served down at the Mayo Clinic. Our military, most of our military people that have served, their coverage is by TRICARE. Does the Mayo Clinic serve military patients with TRICARE insurance?
Madam Chair, I can't speak to that with absolute numbers the way I would with other payer mixes. I can tell you, I'm the chair of anesthesiology, and in the Department of Anesthesiology, I have intensive care services, operating room services, and a very sophisticated interventional pain clinic service. And we have taken several veterans that have really insoluble pain problems and brought them into our mix so that we could put spinal cord stimulators in, get them off of narcotics, do different things like that. So we have kind of greased the skids personally for some of the pain work that we've done, but I would have to get other numbers to know exactly how many people from TRICARE that we've actually treated.
Madam Chair, and just
it does seem like a specific question, and it occurs to me that that we should try to get the answer right. For the committee.
Madam Chair. The reason why I asked, I had a constituent call, a military retired, and the Mayo Clinic was not on the list for a facility to treat TRICARE patients.
Representative Norton, that might be just some information that you could get for the committee after that. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Norton, thank you for bringing this forward, and thanks for the work that you're doing on this. And my question would be anyone from the clinic to respond to this question. When we look at Minnesota and basically in relation to other 50 other states in the country, the other 49 states in the country, and we are in competition not just with other states but other countries for medicine, and it's one of the things that we do well. When I think about the Mayo Clinic, I think, if we were going to take the Mayo Clinic and place it anywhere in the world, no offense, but it probably would not wind up in Olmsted County.
so I kind of understand the fact that we have great needs for getting people from all over the world in and out of Olmsted County. You probably wouldn't, if you were a site selector, place it in the middle of Olmsted County. So we got people coming from other states and other countries that create a specific need. Also understand that the Mayo Clinic has other clinics in Florida and in Arizona that we compete a lot with for jobs on a daily basis. And I'm wondering if some folks from the Mayo Clinic could tell me specifically, the Mayo Clinic is going to be around for another 100 years, I hope, and I'm pretty confident of that. I want to see that growth take place here in Minnesota and in Olmsted County, and then not in Maricopa County or in Florida, in Jacksonville, Florida. Can you talk a little bit about the growth and the difficulty in terms of growing in Olmsted County versus places that it's easy to grow, like Scottsdale, Arizona, or Jacksonville, Florida?
Dr. Narr, are you the appropriate person?
Madam Chair, I'll do my best to try and answer that.
Relatively briefly, though.
Absolutely. So Florida and Arizona are part of our concept of one Mayo Clinic with a national presence. They're approximately one-fifth the size of the operation that we have in Olmsted County. They don't take care of any babies. They don't do any obstetrics. And many of their different surgical procedures are in far lower volume than we would consider what destination surgical procedures might be. Major pelvic tumor resection, huge numbers of neurosurgical cases, probably the largest cardiac surgical practice outside of Cleveland Clinic. So, one, I think we're big and robust, and I think we want to grow in Minnesota. The second thing is this, is there's a Mayo Clinic health system across I-90 from all of southern Minnesota and going up into Wisconsin. It's 19 hospitals and 950 physicians employed by the Mayo Clinic. The care model that we're using there is a reflection of what's happening in medicine right now nationwide. We believe that there has to be a lot of local care on the primary care level. We have to have hubs, which we have four of, that take the next level of care up. And then when you need a destination, when you need that fancy care, Rochester is the hub, actually, for the entire health system. If you look at just pure patient numbers, approximately 1 million patients interact with Mayo Clinic physicians each year. Half of those patients are in the Mayo health system. The rest of that half million is divided between Rochester, Florida, and Arizona. So, yes, we will be a hub in Minnesota for tertiary and quaternary care. We're going to make decisions about where we need to grow. If it turns out with the changes in health care, with the Affordable Care Act, that the Medicare patient becomes our best payer, and we have to go where there are more Medicare patients, there are about 2 million Medicare patients around Rochester, Minnesota that can get there within 100 miles. There are 30 million patients like that around Phoenix, Arizona. So those are the questions that we're deciding, you know, right now. But there's a lot of ifs, because even though Minnesota has begun to create its exchange, most states aren't as progressive or as intelligent as the state of Minnesota, and I think that there are going to be a lot of ifs. When is this exchange going to happen? How are these people going to be insured too? So yeah, we got a big practice. We want to keep it here, and we want to grow it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Norton. I understand that we're not just competing with the Cleveland Clinic and Johns Hopkins, but we're also competing with Jacksonville and Phoenix for future investment of Mayo dollars, and also where patients can go. They can go wherever they want. Understand that. Also want to know specifically what is, I know that the governor is in Rochester today, and I hope somebody asks him very specifically his commitment level to this project. I know he has been able to very strongly commit himself to certain building projects ahead of the legislature and invest a lot of personal capital in doing so. And I'm wondering what his commitment level is to this project and what we can expect from him starting today in Rochester.
Representative Norton looks like she wants to respond.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Dean, thank you for pointing out that the governor is in Rochester today, as is Tina Smith and his chief of staff. They are interviewing and talking with folks. They have already met with Representative Lincheski and Senator Skoy. moving this bill forward. Senator Senchum and I had the opportunity to meet with the governor's staff about 2 weeks ago, right before a break, and they were quite clear that the governor is unwavering in his support. He did have some concerns that were raised by our chair here and Chair Lincheski about the way the bill was maybe funded and the impact on the state, and asked us to, you know, and he shared those concerns publicly, and just they've asked us to look at other opportunities to make this bill move forward. The support for it is unwavering. How we do it is what's really in flux right now, and I know they've had a meeting this morning with Chair Lincheski, and there are some other opportunities and options for changes to the bill that might make it more palatable for both the chairs, and but certainly, you know, we're working to keep the governor's support as well, and I don't think we'll have any problem with that.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems how it was all people on that side of the aisle that were singing the praises of this, and it's actually passed through my committee, and seems like years ago. I do want to say how supportive of I am of this particular program. I have visited some of the other medical centers that have been compared here, and actually when you compare some of the other locations where some of those other major medical facilities are, there is a good reason you have a major medical facility in Rochester. You don't want to walk more than a few blocks away from the major medical centers in other cities. And in Rochester, you can walk just about anywhere. So there is a lot of good pieces to this, and I will go over some of them. I am somewhat, and I've had private conversations in the office about how you're going to build the infrastructure of small companies around Mayo and expand the research, which gives it a sense of entrepreneurship for me, which is really, really important. If you look at what has happened in Boston and in Baltimore and in Cleveland, the spinoff companies that have come out of their major medical centers are phenomenal, and not to forget California and Sanford. I did like the financing model as it was first proposed. It is groundbreaking. We could have done it. We should have done it with all the on and off ramps that we needed for that particular type of funding. We are a state that I've said it here. I've said it in every committee. We don't do much support for business development in this state. We are starting to turn that around. I hope to present a bill this afternoon that will do that. Other states have just totally passed us by. Rochester, Cleveland, they damn near wrote a check from the city to say, what do you want? Ask us what you want, we'll get it for you. Same in Baltimore. Same in, not quite the same in farther north on the East Coast. Foreign countries, the government of those foreign countries have built the facilities and pretty much turned the keys over to those medical facilities and said, all we're asking for you to do is come in and take ownership and run it. Here, Rochester has stepped up to the plate, or the Mayo Clinic has stepped up to the plate. With $3.5 billion worth of their own investment, their own capital. I don't know of another company in this state, in this region, that has stepped up and offered to put $3.5 billion of their own money up to build an industry in this state, in this region. It will become the premier medical facility for the whole Midwestern region, if not the whole United States, and henceforth, with the reputation that Mayo brings with it, the world. My only want is, in to the Mayo Clinic, is to not get lost in the details of this and forget the entrepreneurial spin-offs that have to come. As an organization, that has not been your strong suit. I hope you, and you've assured me that it is being turned around. And if we do that, this is not a $3.5 billion investment on your part. This is not a $5 billion investment for the state of Minnesota. It could easily double that over the next 20 or 25 years. So, and the original financing package of income tax increment financing, because of the cash flows for state governments and federal governments, it very likely and should have been one of the ways that we looked at financing this. As scary as it is, we are not paid by our constituents to run from trouble. We are told to run into the breach and figure it out. And we should, I wish we would have done it the original way, because it would have broken ground in the state of Minnesota and made us a leader and brought companies to this state that would have had a presence here for 50 or 60 years. Now we're going back to the same old, and it is a problem for us as a state as we try to build the economy, build a healthy economy for our great-great-grandchildren.
Members, we have another committee coming in. Representative Albright, if you could just quickly, you're the last person on the list. We don't have much time, but just give us the nature of your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this would be for the consultant, Mr. Dunn. I'm looking at the spreadsheet of building projects, and candidly, it looks like a lot of steel, looks like a lot of concrete, looks like a lot of labor to put that up. I'm just wondering if there's been a consideration and or a pro forma that would suggest the amount of sales of construction materials and or the labor itself that would be needful of these projects, and, you know, commensurate with that, the amount of sales tax revenue from the materials and labor that would be generated based upon those two items as you look at building out these structures.
Mr. Dunn, because, I mean, literally the other committee is, that's a specific question with content. Can you get that to us in writing, and we'll distribute it to all of the of the committee?
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to do that.
I mean, it's very specific. Just in closing, members, one of our staff did the math, and so we're just asking you to check that again. I think somebody heard that you said the private investment ratio was 10 to 1. They did the math from the master plan, page 3 and 6, they said, and it looks more like 4 to 1 rather than 10 to 1. So we're just, apparently someone earlier testified, and we would just like to have you check that. And then minutes, Representative Albright was ready, or no, Fitzsimmons is ready to move the minutes, I think.
I would move the minutes of...
Any changes to the minutes? All in favor say aye. Those opposed? Aye. Those minutes are approved. And to Rochester, one more thing, and maybe to Representative Davids, too. Here is the, you know, those of us who chair these committees ultimately have to be fair to the whole state. And the one thing that weighs heavily on me is if we use up all of our debt capacity for a couple of big projects, we can't be in a position where we say no to Truman and to, I mean, to all of the other parts of the state that we need to keep economically healthy. I mean, ultimately, yes, there will be one vibrant project, but if it's not in a state with shared investment where we keep all of the other parts of the state healthy, I think that is an issue for us. And that's why the part of debt capacity weighs heavily on me.
And Madam Chair, I would just say if and when the DMC is successful, the debt capacity will be increased in the state of Minnesota because of the boon in funding we're going to bring to the state. So I think that'll help offset your concern.
That is the hope. Meeting is adjourned.